It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, oil companies would be able to bid for the right to drill in waters previously protected by federal law. That's under a new proposal being floated by the Trump administration. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, after 10 years on the job, Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn is officially calling it quits. In a press conference yesterday alongside Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, Flynn announced his retirement from the force and reflected on his career in law enforcement.
Now, I became a police officer nearly 47 years ago. I've been a witness to and a participant in historic changes in policing. Becoming chief in Milwaukee was the fulfillment of a career dream. I promised the residents of this city when I was first sworn in that I will not let you down. I've done my professional best to fulfill that promise.
During his decade as Milwaukee's police chief, Flynn brought a lot of changes to the department. He was also at times the recipient of significant criticism from the public and oversaw the department during several high-profile incidents, including the 2014 shooting death of Dontre Hamilton at the hands of a white police officer. Chuck Quirnbach joins us now to talk more about Flynn's decade as police chief, his decision to retire, and how that decision is being received by city leaders. Chuck is a WPR reporter in Milwaukee. He's covered Flynn for much of the past decade. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
We'll look back at Ed Flynn's career, but is there any kind of indication as to why now for a retirement?
Well, the criticism had stepped up in recent months. The Milwaukee Common Council has been pushing for more control over the over the hiring and firing of police chief, currently assigned by the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. Also, sort of the cumulative criticism of the decade, I think, had sort of caught up with Chief Flynn. He's, 69, getting up there in age, and maybe lost a little bit of energy for the job. His problem was that he was left of center Democrat, and therefore never got along with the conservatives in the city. And he also angered some liberals in the city by some of his traffic stop policy. And also there, as you mentioned, there were several actually African Americans that died in encounters with police. So his reception in some of the African American community was not all that strong.
Take us back 10 years, Chuck, when Ed Flynn was first appointed as chief of the Milwaukee Police Department. What kind of shape was the department in? What was crime like in the city?
Well, he came in not long after the Frank Jude case, when officers had beaten an African-American man, a mixed-race man, at a party. There were ongoing crime concerns, although the crime was somewhat down from the peak murders in the 1990s. Crime was still a concern, and for some of that tenure, Flynn led to Flynn's policies and other circumstances, of course, brought crime down. But in the last 3 years, about 3 years ago, murders spiked quite a bit again. They've come down the last year or two, but and he said that he wanted to stick around through last year when the murder total had dropped 15-18%. So he got that in his final year. But there were some ongoing concerns and some high-profile cases. Still, I think, generally speaking, the politicians and the community are saying things were better under Flynn than they had been under some other chiefs.
And he had brought in the idea of a data-oriented policing. He came in promising a lot of change. He was brought in, I think, to bring a lot of change. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And the use of a lot more mapping and the shot spotter technology that relays when shots are heard in certain neighborhoods. Very much, the Center Street initiative that he talked about, putting more resources into a troubled neighborhood in Milwaukee. All of those things led to his, reputation as a high data person. The downside for some folks came out in the federal report that was released, leaked last year, really a draft report, as to whether he had done enough in terms of just basic community, police community relations. You can be very strong on data, but it's still, and a lot of it is still interpersonal relations at the street level, and some felt he hadn't done enough there.
You mentioned that there were reasons for various groups to not be happy with him. On one hand, he was a supporter of stronger gun regulations, limitations on the kinds of firearms that were available to be sold. Can you talk about his advocacy for that and how people might have reacted to that?
Right. Well, certainly, I think that part of it had some strong support in Milwaukee from people that see too much gun violence here. And he testified at the state capitol several times on behalf of stronger gun controls and also more punishment for people who committed a crime while having a gun. Conservatives didn't like it all that much, but on the other hand, they hopefully realized that 80% of the murders here are committed by firearms, so there was some acknowledgement of the firearm issue, but it didn't win him friends in the conservative community, that's for sure.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach about the announcement from Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn that he's going to retire. You mentioned some high-profile deaths of black Milwaukeeans. One that got a lot of national attention was the shooting death of Dontre Hamilton. There's criticism of Chief Flynn and the department over the death itself, but then also backlash from the police union for Flynn's firing of the officer involved in that shooting. Can you talk about how all that played out?
Right. In the case happened a few years ago. Hamilton was in an encounter with an officer, white officer, right in downtown Milwaukee, right across from City Hall. Mr. Hamilton died during the encounter. There was a lot of marches, a lot of concerns raised by the African-American community, Hamilton's relatives and so on, against Officer Christopher Manny. Eventually, Police Chief Flynn did fire Manny for violating department policies, and then Flynn asked the U.S. Justice Department to engage in this so-called collaborative reform review, working with the police department, and those, as you say, some of those policies have been put in place, some haven't been. But you know, the firing of Manny did not win him more friends, as I said, with the police union. They've been a pretty strong critics of Flynn throughout, and yesterday said they were happy to see Flynn go, basically.
You mentioned that federal collaborative report, and you mentioned earlier, Chuck, that a draft of that had been leaked. Is there any indication that we're ever going to see the final version of that report?
Well, I think U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has sort of said no to that, that a lot of that was written during the Obama administration, another attorney general, and I think maybe that's all we're going to see, at least until somebody leaks more. Flynn, you know, originally said the draft report had plenty of errors in it and was somewhat dated from having been written in 2016. But he acknowledged that some things were going to change, or he hoped some things would change. Today, we're hearing folks who say that some things did not change enough, and they're hoping the next chief puts into place more recommendations from that federal report.
Let's talk about what comes next. There's going to be a search for a new chief, and there's some question about where that person should come from. Here's a clip you sent us from Milwaukee Alderman Robert Donovan addressing that question at a press conference.
I think there's something to be said for someone who has roots in Milwaukee. I think for morale purposes and other reasons, I think promoting from within is certainly desirable. Not necessarily the only route to go, but I think desirable.
I know we're very early in this process, Chuck, but talk about that idea of an internal candidate versus a nationwide search.
Well, the acting police chief that will immediately replace Chief Flynn when he officially retires February 16th, we presume the acting chief will come from within the ranks of the Milwaukee Police Department. The Fire and Police Commission will begin talking about that process later this week. It may be in closed session, a lot of it, but they'll be working on the acting chief. And then we talked to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett today at a function, and he's, you know, hoping things move along sooner than later, that the question will be, is the permanent, well, I hate to use that word, is the non-acting, more replacement chief down the road in a few months going to serve just two years, basically the rest of Flynn's term, or a longer period of time. So there's many questions. The mayor has been a strong backer of Flynn. We talked about all the criticism of Flynn. Well, he's had a strong backer throughout, Mayor Tom Barrett, who says he's sorry to see Flynn go and has earned the right to retire. But now Barrett and others will be talking about who should be the next chief, but it is up to the city's Fire and Police Commission, many of whom are appointed by Barrett.
And there are two big law enforcement jobs in the Milwaukee area. Milwaukee County Sheriff, former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, left office. They're still searching for the replacement for him, isn't that right?
Well, Governor Scott Walker has been holding off on naming a successor. He's been reviewing many applicants, including Acting Sheriff Richard Schmidt. And so we're expecting something from the governor relatively soon. But yes, there's a vacuum being created at the top, at least in terms of long-term policies and vision at both the sheriff and police department.
As we wrap up, what are the biggest challenges facing the replacement for Ed Flynn, the new police chief of Milwaukee, whenever they're appointed?
Well, Alderman Donovan today talked about, you know, even though murders were down 15-18% last year, the number of non-fatal shootings, I think, went up a bit. And, 120 people got killed last year, mainly by gun, but not necessarily entirely. And isn't that a high number, a three-digit number? When are we going to get the numbers back down below 100 as they were for part of Chief Flynn's tenure? So just the basic violent crime issue, the opioid issue and perhaps its effect on violent crime, and also sort of quality of life, things like traffic fatalities and people running red lights and so on. There's a quality of life effort that some aldermen would like to see more attention paid to.
And briefly, Chuck, did Ed Flynn give any indication of what happens in retirement?
I think he's going to is talking about more time with his grandchildren.
We'll leave it there. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbach is a WPR reporter. He's based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the retirement of Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn and his 10 years with the department. First, the Trump administration unveiled a proposal last week that would allow oil companies to bid on drilling rights in federally protected waters. The plan from the Department of the Interior would put it in line with President Trump's call for more domestic energy production. The move has gotten a lot of criticism from environmentalists as well as state governors from both parties. Steph Tai is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, specializing in environmental and administrative law. Steph, thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
Well, this is a draft plan, as I understand it. There's going to be feedback from governors and other people. This could change. That said, if it went through as written, what would change when it comes to oil drilling and exploration on the coast?
Well, it would reverse Obama's order to withdraw pretty much many, many offshore lands from drilling. So if it was successful, then it could open up all these lands for drilling. That said, there are a lot of barriers, as you noticed. The states could object to it. In order to even get to these sort of offshore lands, they would actually need to go through state waters depending on their structure. And states could also object to that, too.
Now, these are executive orders going back and forth here. Are there laws in place? And if so, what kind of laws are we talking about?
Yeah, so when Obama withdrew these lands, he did so under the Continental Outer Shelf Lands Act. And that has a provision in there that says that the president of the United States may, from time to time, withdraw from disposition any of the unleased lands of the Outer Continental Shelf. Now, the Outer Shelf Lands Act didn't actually have any provisions for putting anything back in. So a lot of water law experts seem to think that this is just a ramping up, that under the Continental Outer Shelf Lands Act, presidents can withdraw land, but they can't actually put anything back in. So there's going to be probably some legal challenges to this attempt to reverse the withdrawal of the Obama administration.
And you mentioned state objections. I understand we've seen some Democratic and some Republican governors of coastal states on the Atlantic coast and Gulf Coast, for that matter, object to this. Are we expecting to see a lot of pushback?
Yeah, it's hard to really say. I mean, a lot of the concerns expressed by both Democratic and Republican governors are both safety concerns, especially given the recent rescission by the Trump administration of some of the sort of safety regulations that were put in place after the Deepwater Horizon spill. So there's sort of safety concerns. There's also touristry concerns. So all of these could sort of rise to the level of enough congressional objection to maybe stop this. It's hard to really say.
You mentioned the Deepwater Horizon spill. That was, what, 7 or so years ago now, still impacts being felt there. Was that seen as a turning point in attitudes toward offshore oil drilling?
I think so. I think a lot of before that, people weren't quite as aware of the sort of damage. I mean, you know, being able to see, you know, the effects of the Deepwater Horizon spill, I think really affected sort of the public view of this. So I think so. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the sort of joint decision to put back these lands for drilling and also to remove these safety regulations.
The argument from the Trump administration and supporters of drilling is that this is a big economic boon potentially toward states in the areas where the drilling would happen, and B, this would be a huge step toward energy independence, not relying on foreign oil so much. How big a difference could this make in both those categories, jobs and energy?
You know, from what I've seen, the economics aren't actually in favor of a lot of the drilling, so it might actually not, and no economist, by the way, from what I've seen in terms of the press, the suggestion is that there's actually not going to be that much demand for drilling in these areas, especially given the fact that states can object to pipelines that pass through state waters. And if that's the case, then the sort of more expensive kind of floating production storage that would be required to sort of get beyond the state objections might actually make things more expensive and too expensive to be sort of economically viable.
Right, and oil prices are on a lower swing for the last bunch of years, but could a decision made now that didn't make much difference in the current economy, if oil prices swung upward again in, I don't know, 5-10 years, this could potentially open the door to a lot of extraction activity?
Yeah, it might. I mean, one of the difficulties of predicting any of this is that this executive order isn't immediate. There needs to be this study first, and that study would result in the formation of what's called a 5-year plan for how the new leases will be offered, and even that might contain some restrictions. So, and that, in turn, because of the lag time in that, it's hard to really predict how that'll sort of fit in with changing oil prices.
Who would conduct that study?
I think it's the sort of Department of Interior at this point.
We're talking to Steph Tighe, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, talking about a plan. It's a draft now from the Trump administration that could ultimately open up a lot of America's coastal waters to oil exploration and drilling. So states seem to be a key player here. Governors will be giving their feedback. If this came into place, what kind of legal recourse could a governor or maybe even a group of governors have if they didn't want offshore lands off of their state to be leased?
There's a number of things they can do. First, they can pressure their congressional representatives to use the Congressional Review Act, which is an act that this current legislature has used to sort of rescind a bunch of Obama, late-term Obama orders. And they could do that to any kind of Trump administration decision. That's one thing. The other thing they could do is that, you know, if any kind of pipelines cross through sort of state waters next to their shores, they can sort of object to that. So they can use their own state authority to either limit those pipelines or just not even allow them, which would sort of stop any kind of offshore drilling that's dependent on those pipelines. So that's the sort of main thing. They have also authority under the Coastal Zone Management Act, which sort of gives them sort of a lot of authority over sort of safety management. So they can do that. And so this could tie up a lot of the sort of offshore oil projects for a while.
You had mentioned that the Trump administration had dialed back some of the safety regulations for offshore oil drilling. What's the status of that? Is that a plan in the works? Is it a done deal? Where is that now?
Well, they published that, I'm trying to remember when it was, a few weeks ago, I think. That is likely to be challenged by a number of groups. It's probably violating the Administrative Procedure Act in some way, perhaps being arbitrary and capricious. I don't know what the likelihood of a successful challenge is, but I'm pretty sure that that'll be tied up in courts for a bit.
Is it likely that Congress would ultimately step in and try to clarify, maybe revise the authorities given to the president and try to clarify this issue from their end?
They definitely can. I mean, it's very similar to what's currently happening under the Antiquities Act and the sort of monuments that were designated by President Obama and sort of more limited by the Trump administration. And there's talk of Congress doing that with the Antiquities Act. They might do so with the Continental Outer Shelf Lands Act. I don't really know.
And what is the timeline now for this proposal and the review process and the study process?
So the review process is going to take a while. Because it's subject to the National Environmental Policy Act and a bunch of other sort of review acts, we're going to have to do studies about the safety of this, the environmental effects of this. So I would guess that it would take at least a year, but I'm not really sure.
We'll leave it there now. Steph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem.
Steph Tai is an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Law, specializing in environmental and administrative law. We've been talking about a recent proposal from the Department of the Interior that would open up protected coastal waters to oil exploration and drilling. First, college campuses around the country saw protests last year over appearances by conservative speakers like Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos. The incident sparked debates over free speech and which voices are tolerated at universities. Our next guest says the answer isn't to bring in more inflammatory speakers. Instead, he says campuses should be searching for conservative voices that have more to offer to a respectful, productive debate. Aaron Hanlon is an assistant professor of English at Colby College. His recent article for The New Republic is called "The Decline of Debate on College Campuses." Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You write that the real crisis on campuses is not threats to free speech, but threats in some ways to the quality of speech. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'd put it this way. The average college student doesn't have tremendous barriers to accessing the world of ideas and information. If a student wants to go online and look up a white supremacist forum and participate in that, and then drive to the local KKK rally, they can do that. In other words, we don't police their lives of the mind. Campuses are not prisons and they're not literal bubbles. So when I think students react with boos and derision when somebody like, for example, Richard Spencer comes to campus, it's largely because these students have already read Spencer's words, they've already thought and talked about his ideas, and they found those ideas wanting. So I think the bigger issue is that certain speakers, like Spencer, for example, come to campus with the purpose explicitly of offending, ridiculing, and causing spectacle. And as anybody knows, when you start off a conversation with somebody who has a different viewpoint from you do, with ridicule or derision or insults, that conversation is less likely to be productive.
Let's take a step back and talk about the role of an invited speaker on a college campus. What is the hope that the community, that students get out of the range of speakers that are brought on?
Well, I do think it's very important for universities to offer environments of intellectual diversity and to provide really a multitude of viewpoints, political viewpoints and ideological viewpoints on campus. But it's crucial, in my view, that the people coming to campus to represent those various viewpoints are foremost interested in the process of teaching and learning and willing to engage with students. So I think what we hope for is not just the diversity of views, but the type of speaker who will come in and engage in good faith with students without ridiculing students and faculty and without looking to punish the other side.
Talk about the process of how speakers are invited to a college campus, given that I'm sure the rules vary from campus to campus.
Right, it does vary, but I think generally what happens is that relatively small groups of students have discussions within their student clubs, which are often politically oriented or politically inflected. They have relatively insular discussions about who they'd like to bring, and then they take that to whatever administrative process is in place for bringing somebody to campus. And so the consequence in practice is that a relatively small number of students have discussions within their own ideological groups to invite speakers for the whole campus.
And you write that there might be a better way, a way to get people from different viewpoints on campus together to bring on a range of speakers. How would that work?
Right. I think a much better way of doing it is for student groups to take the initiative to talk together across ideological divides, across the aisle, and really to discuss and to debate and to negotiate what they want out of campus speakers on both sides or on all sides, and what types of speakers or which speakers they would want to bring so that they can generate buy-in before bringing somebody to campus. And I think while that's not going to solve every single problem, what it's likely to do is produce less likelihood of really extreme speakers who are basically meant to just punish or offend the other side, and less likelihood as well because of ideological buy-in across the aisle of extreme protests that might be disruptive.
Aaron Hanlon is with us from Colby College. His recent piece in the New Republic is called The Decline of Debate on College Campuses. I want to give a listen to then-President Barack Obama talking in 2016 about tolerating opposing viewpoints that can come to a campus.
Anybody who comes to speak to you and you disagree with, you should have an argument with them. But you shouldn't silence them by saying you can't come because, you know, I'm too sensitive to hear what you have to say. That's not the way we learn either.
Do you agree with that, Aaron? Or is there a point where there's an inflammatory speaker who students should try to stop from coming to campus, or a university should reject an appearance?
I agree with that, the spirit of that statement, with some caveats. I think for one, a lot of the reason that students reject speakers isn't because simply they're offended by that speaker, but actually because they have grappled with and weighed that speaker's ideas and found those ideas wanting. And that relates to the second point on this issue where I would disagree with Obama. Simply that we don't have infinite time and infinite resources. So in theory, it would be great if we could all always hear out every other view and weigh them all together in a perfect marketplace of ideas. But in practice, it might make more sense to think more concertedly about what we want out of speakers and not simply use college time, students' time, and resources, including taxpayer resources, to host and hear just anybody on campus.
Some people might hear that and say, okay, that means, in effect, it's a long way around of saying you're going to censor certain voices. You're going to prevent certain viewpoints from appearing on a campus.
Well, here it's important to think, again, more specifically about what actually constitutes censorship in these cases. It's certainly tricky in the case of public institutions because, as I understand the law in that regard, public institutions have a kind of state actor responsibility, which means they get treated sort of like a public square. I'm not qualified to remark on the nuances of First Amendment law. I know that there are also ways of contesting the viewpoint that I've just voiced. But fundamentally, what I can say, what I am comfortable saying, is that there's a difference between freedom of expression and freedom to choose your platform when you want your platform, to choose your audience, and to choose your audience's reactions. So I don't think that campuses need to be in the business of ideologically restricting speakers or restricting them based on their ideological viewpoints. I think the way to assess a speaker's value is more to do with their interest in the practice of teaching and learning and whether they've demonstrated such an interest.
Last year, a law passed in Wisconsin allows state universities to expel a student if they're found to be disrupting a campus speech or event on three occasions. Other states have taken up similar laws around the country. Here's a listen to Wisconsin State Senator Leah Vukmir talking about why she sponsored that legislation.
It's a very important issue because our First Amendment rights are under attack all across the country, and I've talked to college kids across the state of Wisconsin on the campuses, and you know, our campuses used to be the place where you have the free exchange of ideas, where you had a chance to, you know, push the window of discussion and learn how to hone your skills in debating, and now we have students who are fearful of speaking.
What do you make of state laws restricting disruptive activities, students disrupting the activities of a speaker?
I think there's some major irony in these laws because the very subjectivity involved in deciding whether a speaker is of quality to be on campus, that very subjectivity that goes into that decision that bothers, I think understandably bothers a lot of conservatives about some of the arguments that I've made on this issue, that subjectivity also applies in to determining whether an act is or a protest is disruptive. So, for example, if a group of students stand silently in the back of a room when somebody's speaking with a big sign or a big banner that distracts or bothers the speaker, is that disruptive? If somebody in the audience laughs at a speaker loudly because they find something funny, but that speaker didn't intend for that to be funny, is that punishable disruption? And that's, of course, not notional, as absurd as it sounds. That, I believe, is partly what happened in Congress when Congress tried to prosecute somebody for laughing too loud during a congressional session. And I want to make another distinction here that's also very important with regard to these types of free speech laws, so-called. That is that our foremost duty as educators at colleges and universities is to the students. They should be our priority. So in any case where there's a possibility of conflict between the speech rights of students and the speech rights of outside visitors who are guests on campus, I think it's incumbent upon us to err on the side of protecting the students. And these laws would seem not to do that.
Aaron Hanlon is with us, assistant professor of English at Colby College. He's talking about debate and speakers on campus, and he says maybe less heat, more light in the speakers who are brought onto campus, but they should be across the ideological range. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the role of a campus administration should be in determining who can and can't speak on campus? What do you think of protests of especially controversial speakers? Do campuses have a right to not bring on someone because they're too inflammatory? Do they have a responsibility to bring on a range of perspectives? What do you think of all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Aaron Hanlon, assistant professor of English at Colby College, about debate on college campuses. He has a piece in the New Republic on the topic. He says, let's have speakers across the ideological spectrum, but higher quality, not maybe so inflammatory, not people who are there just to be provocative. Call 800-642-1234. Is this a debate you've been following from a college campus or from outside of a campus? What do you think the role is of an administration in determining who speaks, what kind of perspectives are heard by students? If you're a student yourself, what viewpoints would you like to see welcome on your campus? Are there some that should not be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. Jerry is with us in Helena, Illinois. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I'm just wanting to share this thought with you. If you look at a model like the Gorvey Dow, William F. Buckley debates that occurred during the late 60s, early 70s, sometimes on Dick Cavett's show, that would be a model that certainly would be needed to be looked at by administrators or whomever, student organizations that are inviting guest speakers. The debates were passionate. They were ideological. They were thought-provoking and exhaustively interesting. How come? Because people were prepared. The two individuals were prepared to debate, not to debase each other.
Jerry, thanks a lot. Debate, don't debase. That might be a good slogan for someone you're looking for, Aaron.
Yeah, I love it. I completely agree with this. I think that's a wonderful model. I was actually just watching a Dick Cavett clip of Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer the other night, which was contentious to say the least. But I think those that we also have really excellent examples, like the one that the caller mentioned, that are useful to follow.
Do you think we've lost that? I mean, maybe not even just on campus, but that idea that, hey, it would be interesting to get a couple smart people from different perspectives on debating passionately but civilly on important issues?
I imagine it happens more than it gets coverage in media for, but I do think there is an extent, again, because the way that the process tends to work is that these smaller, more ideologically homogenous communities are the ones selecting speakers and planning events within those communities, kind of like what we've seen at the national level in Congress. There's less willingness to reach across to the other side. And so I don't think people are actually even as aware sometimes that there might be two people who would be excellent to bring together.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Go next to Paul with us in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hi. You know, I think your speaker's heart is really in the right place in terms of, and it's pretty smart to think in terms of more enlightened speech, as you said earlier, Rob. But my problem with this is this desire to preempt or cherry pick something that leads to only having speakers kind of from and of the academic class. And I think a great thing about being a student is you're young enough to be learning tolerance for people who maybe don't have the same backgrounds academically and perhaps are not as erudite, but yet that you give the chance to speak and be able to hear perspectives voiced in ways that sometimes are jarring or uncomfortable, that in life you will be out of academia, you will be exposed to people who maybe don't speak the King's English or maybe don't have the best arguing points, but yet their viewpoints do matter. So I have a problem with some of what he's saying in terms of it narrows the spectrum of tolerability of hearing people. And I think I don't think it's incumbent to protect students from that. I think it's incumbent upon the university to protect them by exposing them to the absolute rigors of freedom of speech.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Aaron?
That's a really important point, and the point is well taken. I want to be very clear that in my understanding, or what I mean in terms of speaker quality, is not just high-minded academic discourse, but I'm also talking about value generated by people who are practitioners, people who are activists of various kinds, people who have political experience, people who have doing community work and community service experience, all of these things. So I'm not suggesting that we only need to have high-minded PhDs going back and forth, although that's good too. The other thing I'd say quickly about this is that students are already exposed to the quote-unquote real world. They live in it. Even on elite campuses, students go out and they experience the world as it is, and they hear all kinds of different perspectives and all kinds of different voices, some of them more worthy of their time than others. The issue is less for me exposure, because I think students are already extraordinarily exposed. The issue for me is more what is a smart way that fits a university mission to allocate our resources and our time on campus.
Paul, thanks for that call. We're talking to Aaron Hanlon from Colby College, looking at campus speakers, the range of perspectives, inflammatory versus enlightened discussion. And we'll go back to your calls now. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Excellent topic, and it really is an issue, and I'm really concerned about what's going to happen with free speech in the future. Because when the Mercer family can fund the little Milo fellow who came into the one college and was just there to be disruptive and combative, because that was his stance and that was his mission, was to go after the liberals and to create all this disruption, and he's still being funded, how can we deal with the abuses of the edges of free speech?
Gail, thanks for the call. Gail referring there to Milo Yiannopoulos, who we mentioned briefly earlier, Aaron. And she's saying this is a speaker who's been foisted on campuses or invited to campuses, but really more of a provocateur than somebody really speaking to issues.
Yeah, this is a really good point and a really challenging issue as well. One thing I think, again, is that's very important is that I really think students need to be impressed upon of the importance of their role in, you know, rejecting somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos, who's going to come mainly to abuse and not for the purpose of having an in-depth, ideologically driven discussion. In other words, I think we won't be as successful in sort of diminishing the role and the influence of somebody like Milo on a college campus with a strictly top-down approach. I think we really need to sort of change the hearts and minds of students and get them to the place where we don't have to tell them, you know, don't invite Milo, you can do better and cheaper. You could get 10 conservative speakers for the price of one of these provocateurs. But really that they know that and that they're the ones driving that choice.
Thanks for the call. Gail, we'll go next to Darren with us in Green Bay. Darren, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I had a comment, I guess, on the law in Wisconsin that causes, you know, basically if you have three disruptions of a, you know, a speaker of some sort, you could be expelled. It seems to me that that law in itself, especially if you're considering ideological debates, that law in and of itself restricts free speech unless there's some sort of definition for what a disruption is. Because, you know, in theory, somebody who got into a somewhat heated debate, as often ideological debates go, you know, somebody having a debate could be considered disrupting.
Darren, I want to jump in because we're just about out of time. Aaron, I know you may not know the exact points of the Wisconsin law on this, but in general, is that a concern you would have?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I think part of the idea of these laws is that they're written intentionally broadly as a way of having a mechanism to kind of punish a certain kind of student protester, mainly on the left, and protect an outside speaker who's a provocateur. So the breadth is a real problem there. Yes.
Thanks for that call, Darren. Briefly, as we wrap up, Aaron, are there lessons that you hope campuses will apply in 2018?
I mean, I really hope, as I've said, that that students across the ideological spectrum can begin getting on the same page and really generating mutual buy-in for ideologically contentious deep learning experiences and co-curricular programming like inviting campus speakers. So I think a starting point might just be for campuses to keep in mind that, you know, there need to be spaces for students across the spectrum to get together and talk. Another thing I'll mention very quickly is that it's also important to protect the speech rights of faculty and to support us when we are out in the world, so to speak, trying to discuss the relevance of some of these issues on campus.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
That's Aaron Hanlon, assistant professor of English at Colby College. He joined us to share why he thinks colleges need conservative speakers, but enlightened ones, people who generate thoughtful conversation, not just provocateurs. People like coffee and treats, people like cats, why not bring them together? A new cafe in the works in Milwaukee will do just that. The Sip and Purr is scheduled to open up on Milwaukee's east side this summer with a cafe in one room and then a cat lounge with cats from a local shelter on the other. I told the Central Time producers about this, and the one with the most audible reaction was... Halima Shah. Hey, Halima.
Hey, Rob.
You like this idea.
This is precious. I love it. Okay, first of all, when you want to unwind... I don't think the key ingredient is necessarily wine or caffeine. It's a cat.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of a cat cafe is amazing to me. I do think, though, that this proves to us that it's important to get your own cat. Because at the cat cafe, you can't have the cat and the coffee at the same time. You have to leave the coffee area and then go over to pet
the cat. For health code reasons,
I mean, yeah, but that just proves that you need your own cat at home.
Now, I understand. I heard after I found out about this, there is such a thing as a cat cafe already in existence in Madison. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you go and hang out at a cat cafe?
100%. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Every day. I would have all of my meetings there, too.
And I understand this one in Milwaukee, these will be shelter cats. You could adopt a cat from there. Would that be a danger for you?
Yes. I have no intention of going there. I already have two.
Okay. Well, thank you, Halima. And maybe we go over there together sometime. Check out the cats.
Yeah, you can adopt a cat.
Not just now. I'm not ready for that yet. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Oh, I would be like Casanova.